Good morning, Your Honors. Victoria Edwards, bar number 39838, representing appellants, Federal Home Loan Mortgage Corporation and One West Bank. Your Honors, appellants are appealing rulings denying their motion for relief under CRCP 60B and their motion for reconsideration under 59A of a default judgment that was issued against them in a quiet title action. This case is about protecting due process rights, Your Honors, and it's also about promoting substantial justice and ensuring the respect and integrity for the legal system remains intact. A default judgment was issued against appellants here, which, if not vacated, stands to wipe out their property interests. This decision is specifically egregious in this situation because the same judge that issued the default judgment only months prior in a Rule 20 action had found, after an evidentiary hearing, that appellants, or at least One West here, not only had standing to foreclose, but also found that appellee, Mr. Bruce McDonald, the borrower here, had in fact defaulted. In fact, Mr. McDonald does not deny that he defaulted here. This here is specifically egregious because the judge knew, based on the evidence, or understood that the evidence supporting One West entitlement to foreclose was proper. Apparently, Mr. Bruce McDonald, trying to determine a way to undo the Rule 20 order, which the court is probably well aware of, is not an appealable order, devised a tactic in order to, in essence, undo that order. He engaged in a form of form shopping and tactical planning, filing two separate lawsuits, one in state court, one in federal court, hiring two separate attorneys, and in essence sat back and waited to see whether or not the parents would essentially mess up. And indeed they did. The parents failed to respond to the state court complaint as amended, and they suffered a default judgment.
Ms. Edwards, your client does not contest that One West was properly served in California, correct?
We do not contest that, Your Honor.
So why isn't this just a situation or a case of unexcusable neglect on One West's part? Can you explain that?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe appellees have muddled up the waters and confused the issues here for the court, unfortunately. As the court has probably pointed out, appellants do not deny the fact that there was no excusable neglect here. However, appellants did not move in the trial court to undo the judgment based on excusable neglect. They moved to undo the judgment on two bases. One under 60B3, that the judgment was actually void because it violated due process under 55F, but also because the judgment was voidable under 60B2 for fraud and misconduct of the attorney. The excusable neglect standard in Goodman does not apply in this particular circumstance. That is not the basis for why appellants were moving to undo the judgment.
Counsel, is it your position that the defendants do not have to show that the reason why they failed to respond is because of the complaint conduct? Isn't there a causal connection? There's an allegation that there was misconduct, but doesn't the defendants have to show that that's what caused them to fail to respond to the complaint?
No, Your Honor, that I believe is the standard under the Goodman excusable neglect standard. That's not the standard that would apply to an analysis under 60B3 for misconduct of opposing counsel.
So if this is a hypothetical, the board of directors sat down of bank, One West Bank or the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, sat down and said, we don't want to respond to this complaint, let's just not deal with it. You would say that you're still entitled to set aside the default judgment.
Well, we would argue that we'd be entitled to set aside the judgment if, in fact, there is some underhanded tactics taken by opposing counsel.
Even if the client intentionally decided they were not going to respond to the complaint.
Hypothetically, that would apply to this hypothetical, yes, Your Honor. But here,
do you have any authority for that?
We do have authority discussing the 60B3 analysis we have for void judgment, but as to the 60B2 analysis for avoidable judgment under misconduct of opposing counsel, there's no real good case law under that issue. It's a new issue that the court would be presented with today. We do make arguments that undoing the judgment under the 60B2 analysis would promote substantial justice, and it would ensure that there aren't inconsistent judgments on the record. As I pointed out previously, the ruling 20 order had in fact found after an evidentiary hearing that one witness was entitled to foreclose. The ruling 20 judge, which is the same judge that issued the default here, had looked at the original note in that action, all the original evidence of debt, and found that the standard to foreclose was proper there. So for this default judgment to stand, in light of that ruling only months prior, would be to promote inconsistent judgments, and that would be an additional reason here.
Rule 120 is not a final judgment, and it's not appealable. It's not correct, and it's not binding on any other court.
It's not appealable, right, Your Honor, but in essence, what we're arguing here, and probably Bruce McDonald did, was, in essence, by obtaining the default, undid the Rule 120 order, where there was an evidentiary hearing. In fact, it was found that one must have the standing to foreclose.
Answer ever filed or tendered by the defendants?
No. Once the default was discovered by the appellants, they contacted our office, and we called up opposing counsel and asked for courtesy in withdrawing the default, and they declined, obviously. So we did file the Rule 60B motion, short time after that.
90 days after that?
Yes, it was a couple of months afterwards.
Is there anything on the record that would indicate why that was delayed?
Your Honor, just that it was during the holidays, I was away on vacation, and once I had come back, that's when I had moved for the client on a daily basis for waiting that period of time. Your Honor, appellants would argue that a default is a serious and drastic remedy, and a request to vacate specifically where there is, where there are substantial real property rights that stand to be affected, should have been liberally construed in favor of movements. It is our position that the trial court did not liberally construe our position below. There were two bases, as I previously stated, that we moved under to undo the judgment. Appellants moved under 60B3, which is a section on judgments that basically says any judgment that is void on its face is void on its face, should be undone and can be undone at any time. It can be reviewed even at the time of appeal. In this situation, Mr. McDonald applied for default and was given it quite quickly, was not required to establish the merits of his position, of any of his claims, and nor did the judge in the trial court issue any findings to establish specifically why the merits of Mr. McDonald's claims had merit. Under 55F, any party that moves for default against an out-of-state defendant is required to make proof of their claims to the court. That is very clear in the case law under 55F.
So what's the standard of proof for that?
The standard of proof, it's not specifically clear in the case law what the standard of proof is, but we do know it requires more than mere allegations and a complaint. It requires proof, in essence. And opposing counsel appellees argue that the mere attachment of documents to a complaint establish proof. That is not proper evidence, attachment to a complaint. And more, either way, we can't tell from the record whether or not the trial court took into consideration any of the attachments, because the order just stated in conclusive fashion that the motion was well taken.
Wasn't there a rather detailed affidavit in support of the motion for the default?
The affidavit was not detailed. It merely discussed the service of the papers on defendants. Did not talk specifically about the merits of the case.
Well, there was an affidavit of counsel that talked about the service, but an affidavit of the of Mr. McDonald, which I thought, I mean, one can dispute how thorough it needed to be, but it spent a good page or so describing the merits, attempting to address the merits.
Yes, Your Honor, it would be a counsel's position that merely making allegations in the complaint and filing an affidavit that mirrored the allegations in the complaint isn't proof that those allegations are in fact proper.
But if those allegations are not disputed, why couldn't the court accept them as true? There wasn't a counter affidavit.
Because under 55F, defendants are entitled to an additional protection here. It's not just a matter of entering a default. There would be no distinction between entering a default against an in-state defendant versus an out-of-state defendant if that was the case. Here, we interpret the statute 55F to require evidence, which is not just merely a filing a complaint and an affidavit that mirrors the allegations in the complaint.
What, how would a trial court determine what's adequate proof? Here there was an affidavit, there were documents, the court said it reviewed the file. What is additional evidence would you have, are you contending was, is required by Rule 55?
Well, this is the problem, Your Honor. There was no analysis of evidence at that stage, and you can tell by how the default was issued. There was just a review of a complaint and attachments. That's not proof. Requiring proof is not just filing a complaint. We would contend appellants had no opportunity to establish proof.
So they had no opportunity. They were served, right?
Yes, they were served. However, the reading of 55F, it can only be induced or deduced from the reading of 55F that proof had to be made, which would require more than a filing of an action. And we contend here that there was no proof made, and the judge didn't require proof be made when the issue was ordered, granting the default judgment.
But if summary judgment can be granted on the basis of an affidavit, why can't a default judgment be granted on the basis of an affidavit pursuant to 55F?
Yeah, but that's a good point. However, based on the record, what we see, that the judge did not convert this into a new summary judgment motion. So we can't presume that the court did that here, and that there was any proof that could have been decided at this point.
So are you saying that there needed to be an evidentiary hearing conducted?
In this particular situation, we would argue that there would be. It's particularly in light of the fact that this judge, only months prior, sat before the parties and issued a ruling, a Rule 120 action after an evidentiary hearing, which established their standing for close. Your Honors, as we stated previously, the motion for entry of default judgment here did not set forth the grounds for judgment. It contained one paragraph, and the court essentially made no findings in regards to how or why it was ruling in favor of Mr. McDonald's quiet title action. This, appellants argue, was a violation of their due process rights under 55F. Opposing counsel appellees attempt to distinguish Martin, which is the leading case under 55F. However, appellees, do not cite any cases that would find a contrary ruling from Martin. Databases for appellants request to vacate the default judgment was under 60 points in 60B2 misconduct of a party. Now, the goal of 60B2, as the court is probably well aware of, is to promote substantial justice. While it's important to end litigation, that the end must be right here. The court could have vacated the default judgment based on mistake, excusable neglect, misrepresentation, or other misconduct of adverse party.
Counsel, your time.
Thank you. Remind the court that justice would only be promoted here if the court would allow appellants to argue the merits of their case at the trial court level. That's all they're asking for here. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court, opposing counsel. I am Eric Schwieso of Lester Sigmund Rooney and Schwieso in Alamosa, representing plaintiff and appellee Bruce McDonald. Unless the court has other questions for me, I intend to spend most of my 15 minutes this morning on the issue that was just being addressed to you, and that is the Rule 55F proof of claim requirement. I don't believe that the bank, One West, has established anything showing that they are entitled under either excusable neglect or misconduct of a party or counsel to having the relief set aside. If there's something that the court thinks I should address,
before you go to the 55 issue, could you address whether on the allegation of misconduct under Rule 60B2, is there a requirement that the misconduct somehow affect your opponent's ability to fully and fairly litigate the issue? And if so, were they prevented from doing so?
Your Honor, I think there is such a requirement. The briefing in my response brief, in a footnote actually, I addressed those cases, and they were addressed in the court below because this issue was raised in the court below. Those cases are Mason Jarris Limited v. Peterson, 939 P. 2nd 522, and in the matter of Bonfils Estate, 543 P. 2nd 701. Those are on page 11 of the answer brief in footnote 2. And in this case, no, there certainly was not any there was no misconduct on my part, and I resent the allegations that there was. Those have been constant throughout this case. Let me also, just for the record, refer you to the record at 255. That details, that's a brief that was filed by me in the trial court detailing the instances of discourtesy on the part not of Ms. Edwards but of the bank's previous counsel, and the record at page 338, which contained an email exchange between Ms. Edwards and me that I consider very discourteous. The allegations of misconduct that have been leveled against me by the bank are, as near as I can understand them, that I did not reach out to the bank and ask them why they didn't answer the default, or why they haven't answered and their time was up, and two, that I misrepresented to the court the status of the note in this case. Both of those, while it's true I didn't reach out to the bank, no reason to. The bank had treated me very poorly. I had, in fact, and this is in the record and cited in the briefing, made the bank's attorney aware of this case in an exchange in front of the court on an FED hearing on this matter that was brought by the bank. So,
saying is that Freddie Mac was at the hearing where you explained that you were in the process of serving the complaint in this in this particular case, right?
Right, that the complaint had been amended and was sent out for service.
But there was no counsel for One West at that time, right?
That's correct. There was no counsel for One West.
And Freddie Mac was not a party to the federal case, correct? A named party.
To the federal case? I don't know, Your Honor. I
sure was not involved in the federal case. Well, how was the bank supposed to know about it? I mean, how did you advise the bank of this? Because you talked to Freddie Mac, but I, is there any evidence that you had disclosed to same information, provided the same information?
No. The only time that I provided information that this case was pending and had been sent for service was that exchange with counsel for Freddie Mac, who and frankly, One West claimed to be acting on behalf of Freddie Mac throughout that process. So I suppose in that sense, there's notice to both, but the case was filed by Freddie Mac. Counsel, who opposite counsel in that case, was there only for Freddie Mac, as far as I know. Again, there's no obligation that I talk about this to anybody, but certainly it was not concealed. It was not underhanded. There was a notice of lease pendants filed prior to, after the 120 order issued. There was a notice of lease pendants regarding this case filed. There was the exchange in the court, and then there was all the service that went on back and forth. So let me just get back then very briefly to the note. Much is made of this note that got discovered somehow and shows up at the end of the trial court proceedings. After the case had been concluded, counsel for One West and Freddie Mac files a motion to reconsider and says, look, you have been misled, court. You've been told that the note was never endorsed, never assigned, never transferred out of IndyMac Bank. And here it is. It's got an endorsement stamp on it. And they file that for the first time after the case is over. That's the first time anyone has ever seen this supposed original note with an endorsement stamp. As is made clear, in page 322 of the record, Rule 120 case that we've been discussing, or counsel for the banks was discussing earlier, 09 CV 41 and 42, turned on the issue of standing. Did the bank have standing to pursue this? Was it a holder or an owner of the note? And throughout, that was in question in that case. And that 120 case went on for a long time, because when the bank initially presented its motion for an order authorizing sale, Bruce McDonald filed an answer saying, no, this bank does not have standing. They're not a holder or an owner of the note. And the court, in the 120 proceeding, required the bank to produce an original. The bank failed to do that. The court denied the motion. The bank then came back and said, oh, you know, we couldn't find the original. But finally, here it is, and it's only a few days or a week after you denied our motion. Please reconsider. And the court reconsidered, and then we had a series of briefing about whether the bank was an owner. Had that note, let me back up. So that got produced. Bruce McDonald went and examined it. I did not. I was not party to the Sawatch is an hour away from me. I didn't drive up there and take a look at this note, and the bank took it back. But the court required then the bank to produce evidence of an assignment of that note from IndyMac Bank, the original payee under the note, to that bank. Bank couldn't do it. And in fact, the bank filed, this is noted in the briefing, the bank filed a status report and said, we can't find, there is no assignment or any evidence showing transfer of the note from IndyMac to us. Had this note with an endorsement on it existed, They wouldn't have filed that status report, and we wouldn't have had months of briefing about that issue. It would have been done. Your Honor, there's a blank endorsement on this note. We're the holder of it. We're good to go. It didn't exist. By their own judicial admission, it didn't exist. Something happened in between. We don't know what. We haven't had a trial on this case. The note with the endorsement, the magical note with the endorsement, doesn't show up until after 10CV6 is concluded in a motion to reconsider. There have been, prior to that time, three or four copies of the original note that the bank had in its 09CV42 case certified to be true and correct. Many instances of copies of that note had been found in the record. Nobody ever said, that's not the original note. Rule 55F and the proof of claim. First, and I think most importantly, that argument was waived. It was not brought up until the motion to reconsider the court's denial of the motion to set aside the default judgment was filed. So all the briefing relating to the motion for setting aside the default judgment, and there was a lot, was over and done with, and the court decided, I'm not going to set aside that default judgment. And then the argument about Rule 55 and inadequacy of the order and inadequacy of the motion and inadequacy of the showing of proof gets made.
His contention, as I understand it, is that the judgment was void because of the Rule 55F defects. So does that, aren't they entitled to raise voidness at any time?
They are entitled to raise voidness at any time, but they're incorrect that the judgment is void because of the Rule 55 defects.
How else can the requirements of Rule 55F be enforced if not by declaring the judgment void?
Well, they could have been enforced in the trial court when, in the first instance, in the motion to set aside, the bank could have said, set this aside because under 55F there's been no adequate showing of proof. And then we would have had that whole argument. What I'm saying is they didn't make that argument to the trial court. They didn't make it until they raised it as a completely new issue on their motion to reconsider after the trial court had already decided. I'm not saying they can't make an argument to that effect. I think they can. What I'm saying is it's not a void judgment ab initio. It's a judgment that is voidable. It's a judgment that is subject to being set aside, but is not void as a judgment for lack of jurisdiction. Where the court doesn't have jurisdiction, you've got a void judgment. Where the court lacks subject matter jurisdiction or personal jurisdiction, you've got a void judgment. And I think a very instructive case on this issue is the Pearson case cited in the briefings, because the Pearson case analyzes the difference between a void judgment and a voidable or a judgment that's subject to being opened. And in the Pearson case, it went back and looked at, I think particularly instructively, a case called Weaver Construction v. District Court, and analyzed the different situation between two defendants in that Weaver Construction case. One defendant had not been properly served. There was no personal jurisdiction, therefore, that was a void judgment as to that defendant. The other defendant, in that case, if I'm remembering correctly, had been properly served, but had an argument and defaulted, had an argument about excusable neglect and a meritorious defense. And that was a judgment that was voidable, subject to being opened. So two very different things. Obviously, if you've got a voidable judgment under Rule 60, you can ask the court to set it aside. Now, there's nothing about what happened in 10CV6 that gives rise to a void judgment. It has nothing to do with due process. What's due process? Due process is notice of the proceedings and an opportunity to be heard. That's what the banks had. In Pearson, there was a due process problem because the defendant in Pearson, not in Weaver that was being discussed by Pearson, but in Pearson itself, had actually filed not an answer but a response with the court. and then the plaintiff moved for a default judgment. There'd been no answer, per se, filed. Plaintiff moved for a default judgment and did not give notice to defendant that they were moving for a default judgment. Under Rule 55, once a party has appeared, they are entitled to notice of the motion for default judgment. So that was a due process issue concerning notice. Here, the bank never appeared. They're not entitled to notice concerning that judgment.
Also, what is the standard of proof, assuming we reach the issue, for a 55F motion?
I could not find any case law on what the standard of proof would be. What it says is, shall make a showing of his claim. I could pour that for the language.
I understand.
I believe that the standard of proof is you've got to show a prima facie case that hangs together. You can't, this is very important, I have 13 seconds, but I want to get at it. The distinction between in-state and out-of-state under 55F is that when you're an in-state defendant and you default, liability is automatic. Liability is automatic. When you're an out-of-state defendant, liability is not automatic. You have to have a showing of proof. So if liability is automatic, it doesn't matter whether your case holds together or not. It doesn't matter whether you've got a prima facie case or not. You defaulted. Out-of-state defendant, you got to have a prima facie case if you're going to prevail.
Okay, thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
And thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted, and we'll render a decision in due course.